Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by yours truly, Kenneth Doust. Today we'll be taking another look at trash reuse, recycling, ecology, and whatnot. But let's circle around these topics a bit before addressing them head on. Let's look at some larger issues. Compared with, say, the Spaniards and the French, Americans are notoriously ignorant about world affairs, economics, and history. That's done on purpose, and for a reason. The less the citizens know of any alternative way of doing things, the more they will see the current economic and political structures as natural and inevitable. They're not, of course. In fact, they're entirely unworkable and unsustainable. But the people who run and profit from these unsustainable systems don't want you to realize that. There is no alternative, as Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher loved saying. That brings me to one of the extremely few benefits of being 60-plus years old. You've been around long enough to remember when things were done differently, right here. And in some cases, the older system worked better than the current one. Young people are often surprised when I tell them that in 1958, say, there weren't any homeless people to speak of. Maybe 75 alcoholics on Skid Row in the Bowery. But there weren't overcrowded homeless shelters in every small town in America as there are today. Nobody died from eating spinach contaminated with E. coli, either. Died from polio, maybe, but not from spinach. Not only that, but almost everybody with a job of some kind had health insurance. The dominant health insurance company, Blue Cross Blue Shield, was a non-profit organization, and accordingly the rates were affordable. So much for progress. Let's get back to reuse and recycling. By 1958, the corporate-sponsored move to make new, sell, discard, and make more new was well underway. But a lot of vestiges of the old school remained. That is, vestiges of the World War II era. I remember trips with my father to Pop's Atlantic gas station. There you could buy a carton of Pepsi, a wooden partitioned frame that held 24 glass bottles of cola. When you were done, you brought back the frame and the 24 empty bottles and picked up a new set. The bottles would go back to the bottling plant in nearby Philadelphia, get washed out, then refilled and resold. And the carton was reused for years. Waste and burden on our landfills? Almost nothing. At least not on the consumer's end. They don't do that anymore. Bottling plants are larger, fewer, and farther away, and the cost of shipping all those glass bottles back to the plant would be high. Most bottles are now plastic. They're never refilled. Even if you put them in your recycling bin, the vast majority of the plastic is never actually recycled and made into something else. Most of it is simply shredded, shipped to the third world, and buried. How much fuel does it take to ship 1,000 tons of ground plastic to India? We heard about this a couple months back when we broadcast the documentary The Lightbulb Conspiracy. And before that, when we broadcast The Story of Bottled Water. We'll hear more about it in a few seconds when we hear another documentary. It's from 2005, and it's called Gone Tomorrow, The Hidden Life of Garbage. The filmmaker is Heather Rogers. Once again, I'll thank Robin Upton of Unwelcome Guests for turning up another excellent video documentary. www.unwelcomeguests.net. One other memory. Decades back, you'd find the occasional good program on National Public Radio. I remember one on garbage, and particularly this item. In the eastern U.S., at the sites of 17th century settlements, archaeologists have found old glass bottles, all hand-blown, of course. The settlers would reuse the bottle for many, many years, and finally discard it when the bottom had worn through. Maybe give this a thought next time you see someone chugging a 6-ounce container of commercially bottled water and then tossing the plastic bottle into the trash. Does this add up to progress? Here's an especially interesting point today's documentary makes. The big and long-running anti-littering campaign is basically a scam funded by industry. It's designed to head off legislation that would prohibit so much disposable crap from being made in the first place by shifting the burden for our ubiquitous trash to the consumer. But the documentary starts off by exposing an even bigger scam. That's the notion that much plastic can be recycled in the first place. Let's have a listen to Heather Rogers' Gone Tomorrow, The Hidden Life of Garbage.
Over the last 30 years, our mountains of waste have doubled, despite the much ballyhooed rise in recycling. According to the official ideology, America is getting greener. We reduce, reuse, and recycle.
When I recycle, it makes me feel good because I feel like I'm helping the environment.
I think it's great for the environment. I think it's an important thing.
I feel like I'm actually doing something for the world.
You know, it's a hip thing. It's like having a higher consciousness.
Recycling makes me feel like
you've done something.
Yeah, I'm doing my part.
If you do it that day, you're like, yeah.
When you recycle, you don't have to use more materials.
Recycling is good for the earth and stuff. I think recycling works.
In reality, recycling isn't so simple. Some materials are more easily recycled than others. Some aren't recycled at all, and many recycling processes cause pollution of their own. Take plastic, for example. Only 5% of it gets recycled, and much of that goes into products that cannot in turn be recycled themselves. Each time plastic is reprocessed, its chemical bonds break down. This is called downcycling, and to overcome this, recycled plastic must be mixed with lots of virgin plastic to be of any use. Downcycling also occurs in processing used paper, and eventually, all plastic and paper is incinerated or ends up in a landfill.
At the Ecology Center, we collect all the food containers in one stream of material, in paper in a second stream of material, and it's separated by hand. Once plastic is pulled off, it gets sent to a machine, and we transport the bottles to our baler, which is similar, if you will, analogy, is like a hay baler. And these bottles are coalesced together and squeezed into a cube that weighs about 1,200 pounds. What happens is these bales are broken apart, and they send through another machine called a granulator. And they get made into granules about the size of a BB. And at that point, that's your raw material from wherever next you send the plastic to. So it's a pretty complicated process.
All this stuff is used for a different thing. It's really weird. Okay, I guess the glass is remelted down. What happened to this? They melt it down and they make a football uniform and jerseys and sweatshirts and stuff. This stuff is valuable. They pay you 42 cents a pound for this stuff. Okay, that's a lot of money.
Plastic is growing at 7 times the rate of plastic recycling, so we're not keeping up.
One of the problems that we face is that plastics recycling has been promoted by a group called the American Plastics Council. And they're also convincing a lot of consumers that all this plastic is actually recyclable. Recycling programs operators like myself have been left literally holding the bag, trying to sell all this plastic or give it away and to what is in essence is a fictional market.
Recycling wasn't always feel-good fraud. Throughout history, people routinely reused materials. In the 19th century, it was big business and a way of life. On Barren Island in Jamaica Bay, where much of New York City's rubbish was dumped, hundreds of people lived and worked among the refuse. Known as scow trimmers and rag pickers, they dug through piles of garbage on the island and on the barges around it. They looked for repairable household items like furniture, dishware, and textiles. They gathered up bones to make soap and fertilizer, rags to make paper, and, with the unidentified dregs left behind, they made imitation coffee and sausage to sell at boarding houses. This intensive reuse of waste continued into the 1940s, when the U.S. government encouraged the public to recycle metal and other materials as part of the war effort. In those days, a single thick glass bottle could be reused up to 40 times. But after the war, everything changed. Mass prosperity brought an explosion of a modern consumer culture based on advertising, image, and the persuasive power of brands and packaging. A new breed of garbage was born.
You. Gleam and only Gleam has the patented GL70 formula to destroy decay bacteria with just one brushing.
Well, what's the difference as long as you've got Tide?
I want this new Philco because it has adjustable shelves, and my husband likes the price tag.
By the late 50s, producers were spending as much on packaging and advertising as they spent on manufacturing. And, as the boom times wore on, markets became saturated. There was just too much stuff and not enough consumption. The trick was to keep people buying, to get the economy to metabolize more products. The strategy, built-in obsolescence.
Make your trips with baby more fun. Wherever you go, go with Playtex Driper disposable diapers.
Capitalism has an absolute imperative to push more and more things out, you know, the products of today render the products of yesterday obsolete. And that keeps everybody buying. And if people don't buy, then you can't make any money, and then accumulation slows down and you get a crisis. So you have to keep the commodities flowing. I mean, that's the absolute fundamental rule of capitalism. So there's a natural tendency towards obsolescence of a technological nature, of a fashion nature, of product design nature. There's a number of ways in which the old world will constantly be rendered obsolete. That's another aspect of capitalism's creative destruction. It isn't that it's just tearing down factories or tearing down places, but it's actually tearing down its own products.
As wages rose during the 50s, private waste haulers turned away from labor-intensive reuse and recycling practices. The new dump would use technology, like the compactor truck and the sanitary landfill. Both of these innovations had been developed during World War II by the Army Corps of Engineers. With thousands of troops concentrated together at domestic bases, managing the mess was a huge project. In fact, the Army drafted Jean Vincennes, the architect of America's first sanitary landfill, to help research methods of compressing and burying mass quantities of trash. As these technologies of war became part of daily life, even freelance scavengers were banned from the dump because they got in the way of the machines.
Once, the land seemed inexhaustible. The whole vast sweep of the American continent, 3 million square miles of the richest land on earth, a land of quiet main streets, rolling farmlands, plains, forests, and mountains. A land with elbow room, with unlimited space for our towns, our cities, and our people to grow.
What you see is on one end, you know, the modern suburb where you could just scrape away the hillsides and pay no attention to terrain. And on the other side, you could take any hole in the ground, any ravine or the edge of the San Francisco Bay, and you could dump your garbage in it, and then you could cover it over with dirt. So that's the modern landfill.
I think the important thing to remember about landfills is that they're not just an unfortunate byproduct of capitalism, they actually represent the success of capitalism. The extent to which profit has been successfully achieved is the extent to which we have more garbage to put in a landfill. What we also need to think about is the amount of labor that went into producing these products, the time that was spent making these products that were specifically designed to wear out faster than they needed to. What else could we have done with that time? What other productive, scientific, creative pursuits could we have invested that time in? What kind of society could we have created alternatively?
American industry, to save production costs,
carries on a continual search for ways of keeping costs down to hold prices down, so our products can be priced to stand out in our competitive American market.
The petrochemical revolution around World War II, we started generating a new waste stream that was heavy on plastics, heavy on synthetics, heavy on toxics. And then we discovered that, of course, once you bury it, it's leaching into the water. It's still a danger.
There's a party in every bottle of NoCal. And don't forget, for picnics and beach parties, NoCal also comes in quick-chilling, easy-to-carry cans.
In 1953, not long after disposable cans and bottles were introduced on a mass scale, Vermont's state legislature passed a law that completely banned the sale of throwaway bottles. Within months, the beverage container industry, seeing that Vermont's law would limit their profits, counterattacked. They started a group called Keep America Beautiful and thus invented corporate greenwashing.
So suddenly you get Lady Bird Johnson and others say that the problem is simply one of beauty rather than of potential real danger, hazard, and even a kind of malignant way of living. But you weren't going to tackle that head on, because that would mean you'd have to tackle, you know, the whole basis of consumer society, which is, you know, fundamental to modern capitalist production and to the whole way the United States works.
But while we're a responsible people with regard to our tangible resources of forests and minerals, how do we treat this important resource for recreation? We go away from home on a vacation and take a holiday from responsibility. We launch a fallout of litter. The litter problem seems to get worse. Sadly and ironically, because of scientific advances and new improvements in modern living, trash only becomes trash after it has first served a useful purpose. It becomes litter only after people thoughtlessly discard it.
So then it's about, you know, if you're not going to tackle that, what other device do you have? Well, it's to say, look, at you, the individual, don't be a bad person and throw the litter out the window. You know, so it's an individual responsibility. Do not litter. Be a good citizen.
The TV ad continues. Now it shows an American Indian in traditional dress paddling his canoe down a stream. The farther he proceeds, the more the environment is fouled by litter. The voice of the narrator may sound vaguely familiar. It belongs to the actor Ronald Reagan.
Some people have a deep, abiding respect for the natural beauty that was once this country. And some people don't. People start pollution. People can stop it.
Keep America Beautiful's campaign worked. Vermont's ban on disposables was undone, and no legislation like it has ever passed again. By the late 1960s, environmental consciousness was on the rise, triggered in part by Rachel Carson's best-selling book, Silent Spring. Though Carson focused on the toxic effects of DDT, her work also helped stimulate a return to recycling and a critique of consumerism in general. Volunteers started neighborhood recycling programs and organized the first Earth Day in 1970, where hippies coined the now ubiquitous term, reduce, reuse, recycle.
This is our constructed wetland gray water system, filters and cleans all the shower water that the house produces, you know, in the sense of recycling and reuse the shower water goes directly into making a vegetable garden. What we do here is dump our food wastes in here, and there's redworms underneath here, and redworms go ahead and chomp away at the food. This was probably dumped maybe about a week ago, and it was straight up food waste before, and obviously is being made into soil right now. This essentially here is sort of, while it looks just like a table, it's actually a compost toilet. You go in there until it fills up, and then can pull the bucket out and take it over to the hot pile compost and dump it and process it. It makes sense that, you know, just like we use the worm casting, so we can use human excrement, if composted well, to make nice soil.
When we salvage for reuse and we save something in its already manufactured form, we conserve both the material and the cultural value and the energy that went into producing the object. Now, if the same object is shredded up and bashed and remanufactured into something new, it's good for it to be recycled, but it isn't nearly as good as if that value had been conserved in the first place by reusing the object as is. You have to use all the resources that you've taken out of the wild. You have to use them as long as you can, and you can't just dig a hole in the ground and bury them.
Today, there are over 9,000 curbside recycling programs in the U.S. More Americans recycle than vote. But for all this, the mountains of garbage continue to grow, and industry's role in waste production, to some extent, remains hidden. Consider this. For every ton of household trash, more than 70 tons of waste are produced by industries like manufacturing, mining, agriculture, and petrochemicals.
Capital's only relation to nature is ultimately its relation to accumulation. But the technological power is so great now that that law of accumulation can mean a law of destruction of the earth and of life on earth at a scale never before seen. Unless society, human beings, thinking human beings intervene to say our only relationship to nature cannot just be accumulation and profit. It has to be that we live on this earth, that we do not destroy this earth, that the beautiful things of the earth are maintained. The only way you can do that is to stop capitalism. To say, no, here you may not go. Here you may not dig. Here you may not transform. Here you may not alter your gene pool. Here you may not pollute the atmosphere. Here you may not burn natural fossil fuels. Social regulation is an inherent part, a necessary part of social life under modern production. And if you don't regulate it, the market misbehaves, the companies misbehave, and you can, you know, drown in your own waste.
So ends, rather abruptly, The Hidden Life of Garbage. If you've been listening to this show for the past 6 months, you've probably already learned that most of the plastic that you recycle never actually gets recycled. So why are most of us going through this elaborate charade of paying a nickel deposit on each beverage bottle, then afterwards rinsing the empty and returning it to the store? Since most of it ends up in a landfill anyway, right next to all the other plastic you place in your recycle bin. Answer, because this charade keeps you off the backs of the manufacturers. They remain free to continue polluting the environment with zillions of tons of disposable crap. It's been less than a year since I first learned that most recycling, in fact, doesn't recycle much. I was as surprised as anybody at first, but every good source I've seen since has confirmed the fact. I shouldn't have been so naive, but I was surprised again when this week's documentary exposed that the huge Keep America Beautiful anti-litter campaign was another industry-sponsored PR ploy designed to increase profits at the expense of the environment. If you have any doubts, consider the casting of the old ad we heard. Now, if they had gotten an ecologist like Rachel Carson or Ewell Gibbons or Bill McKibben to narrate it, that would have been one thing. I suspect that, if they had been asked, all three would have told the ad agency to go pound sand. The fact that they hired that old hack and corporate pitchman Ronald Reagan as narrator tells you all you need to know about the purposes of the campaign. For a complimentary view, let's hear again just a couple of minutes of Annie Leonard's The Story of Bottled Water.
In a recent full-page ad, Nestle said, "Bottled water is the most environmentally responsible consumer product in the world." What? They are trashing the environment all along the product's life cycle. Exactly how is that environmentally responsible? The problems start here with extraction and production, where oil is used to make water bottles. Each year, making the plastic water bottles used in the U.S. takes enough oil and energy to fuel 1 million cars. All that energy spent to make the bottle, even more to ship it around the planet, and then we drink it in about 2 minutes? That brings us to the big problem at the other end of the life cycle, disposal. What happens to all these bottles when we're done? 80% end up in landfills, where they will sit for thousands of years, or in incinerators, where they are burned, releasing toxic pollution. The rest gets collected for recycling. I was curious about where the plastic bottles that I put in the recycling bins go. I found out that shiploads were being sent to India, so I went there. I will never forget riding over a hill outside Madras, where I came face to face with a mountain of plastic bottles from California. Now, real recycling would turn these bottles back into bottles. But that wasn't what was happening here. Instead, these bottles were slated to be downcycled, which means turning them into lower quality products that would just be chucked later. The parts that couldn't be downcycled were thrown away there, shipped all the way to India just to be dumped in someone else's backyard. If bottled water companies want to use mountains on their labels, it would be more accurate to show one of these mountains of plastic waste. Scaring us, seducing us, and misleading us. These strategies are all core parts of manufacturing demand.
Thanks for listening. New World Notes comes to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. To send feedback, to learn more about the show, or whatever, check out our website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. That's newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Illegitimi non carborundum, keep giving all you can, and please come back again next week. Ciao.